Thank you, everybody. Hoping that you can all see this presentation. So yeah, I'm going to talk for around about half an hour, hopefully, on the print revolution. And this is really kind of very much, as I'll explain later, my day job has been as a trade journalist, writing on a trade magazine about the printing industry. And it kind of occurred to me that the day that I've really kind of lived through so far, a real revolution in kind of what's happening in printing, and knowing kind of how important that technology revolutions are in general to Marxists, and how important they were to Marx and Engels, and explaining, for example, the transition from feudalism to capitalism, and explaining also how it creates the conditions for a society of common ownership. It struck me this might make an interesting presentation for everybody. So I'm going to talk about the digital printing revolution in my own little sphere of print, and also how that's pushed out to become a global revolution. And then we'll finish off with some thoughts about how this might impact the future. So in general, what is an industrial revolution? Say Marx and Engels write about it a fair amount. The conclusion is it's a changing technology that propels economic, social, and ultimately political change. At the same time, it increases profitability levels for the capitalist class, creates redundant skill sets, so redundancies. But at the same time, in a kind of contradictory nature, it opens up new vistas and potential for a future socialist society. So we're living through many commentators today are calling the fourth industrial revolution. And it's really marked by the exponential speed of change. So whereas before the real kind of driver of change was really more mechanical, today the drivers of change are really based on big data, machine learning, networks, artificial intelligence. These things have a much shorter reproduction cycle. So change is speeding up dramatically. The other thing with Industry 4 or the fourth industrial revolution is that it destroys white-collar skills. And by white-collar skills, I mean those which rely upon human cognition as opposed to manual skills. It was the last really three industrial revolutions which destroyed a lot of the old manual skills. Industry 4 is destroying those skills as well, but at the same time, it's really starting to eat into what we used to call white-collar work, cognitive functions. Same time, the fourth industrial revolution has accelerated deunionization. It's led to an atomization of the workforce. And we can see this across a whole range of different aspects of work. We call the Uberization of society. Marx also makes the point that industrial revolutions in general don't just affect the one particular industry that they take place in, but as he says, it disrupts and ripples through neighboring productive sectors, destroying older skills and replacing them with automated machinery, in which labor is increasingly unnecessary and possibly eliminated altogether. So let me just explain something about my strange little niche of the print industry, labels. So what I write about is the printing of labels, and that's been what I've been doing for the last 30-odd years. So as you know, every product has a label. Every time that you eat, drink anything, buy some pharmaceutical products, or time you get a parcel from Amazon, every time a pallet gets moved, everything has a label, and of course it all has to be printed. So What makes label printing slightly different from the general print market, newspapers and magazines and books and such like, is that it requires specialist printing machinery. So if you think about a self-adhesive postage stamp, that's kind of what we're talking about. So you've got the stamp itself, which has got adhesive on the back of it. It comes off a lining material, so it can release from that. It has to be cut out with a die. The shape of it has to be cut out with a die. So this is really kind of what we're talking about in the label industry. It's quite specific equipment. And there is even a show, the gloriously named Label Expo show. I've been going to those shows now since, I guess, 1997. And as we'll see, they've really been a kind of marker of how the label industry, on the back of the consumer branded goods industry, has really moved out globally. So let's talk about what print was. And I know that when I first joined the party back in, that was probably when 86, I guess, there were a lot of comrades then who were in the print industry or had been in the print industry, the traditional print industry. And indeed, I do recall that we used to have an offset printing press at party headquarters. I have no idea what happened to that. But anybody who was around at the time, of course, remember those glorious smells of solvent inks and such like. So what really defines traditional printing is the reproduction of a fixed image carried on a printing plate. So if you have a look at that image there, that's a flectographic printing plate. Think about potato printing, where you're going to have the ink, those images, the printing dots slightly stand, slightly proud from the surface. And then you're going to ink those like you ink a potato, and then that's going to go straight onto the printing surface, the paper or the film. There are other different techniques for printing, offset printing, gravure and such like, but in the label industry, this is probably one of the most widely used print industry. But nonetheless, the principle is still the same. Whichever process you're using, it's a fixed image on the printing plate. So you can see there are four images across that plate. Four labels. Once I start printing it, I can't change it. Those same four images are going to be reproduced for as long as I'm printing on that press using that plate. If I want to change jobs, then I'm going to need to change over that printing plate. I'll need to stop the printing press. I'm going to need to laboriously clean all the ink off from each printing unit. I'm going to have to get my tools out. I'm going to have to take off the cylinder that holds the plate. Take off the dies with tools, and it can take anything up to a morning. When I first started writing about this industry, it would take a skilled printing crew probably 4 or 5 hours to change over from one job to another. When you watch the press working, you normally have two press operators rushing up and down the press, changing things like the printing pressure and the alignment between the printing units and such like. So very highly skilled manual work. So this is a typical label press, just so that we know what we're talking about. So if you see over here, this is where the paper comes in or the film comes in. These are individual colors, cyan, magenta, yellow, black, etc. It comes through here. The image is built up, comes through here. And this is where the die cut unit is. Think again of your printing stamp. It's going to cut out the shape of the label. Then that label is going to be applied in the Coca-Cola factory or whatever to the actual container itself. It's another one, it's a Danish company called Niel Peter, but it's the same principle. You can see there all the inline printing units and the finishing units. On the top rail there, you can see things that put like foiling, all these sort of things that make us want to buy one brand of shampoo compared to another brand of the same shampoo. Now, this is where the revolution begins. In 1993, in Birmingham, there's a trade show, now defunct, called IPEX. And it was it's where we first saw this squat little box. And this was an early prototype of a new kind of digital label press. Now, think about what we saw earlier. Think about these. And now think about this. So basically, what you've got inside this box, this little wardrobe, is printing units, the same kind of things that you find inside your printer on your PC at home. This one had four colors: cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. And it was developed by an Israeli chap called Benny Lander, who's a visionary in the printing industry. Really, he's kind of famed and for his saying that in the future, anything that can be printed digitally will be printed digitally. Now, in these early days, it was all pretty dodgy stuff. So it wasn't running live, and they cut a hole in the side of the stand, and they were handing through pre-printed sheets and pretending it'd be printed on the press. It was all pretty kind of primitive stuff, but the future was kind of written. 10 years later, Hewlett-Packard acquired this company, Indigo, and the take-up of the machines had become much more industrial and robust. And 10 years later, around about sort of 2004, 2005, one quarter of all new printing press sales in the labor market were digital printing presses. So the real kind of key thing here is that it doesn't need printing plates. Again, just like your printer at home, because every rotation of a drum can print a different image. In this case, it uses sort of liquid toner technology, which is kind of like you get in your Xerox printer, except it's suspended in a liquid. But nonetheless, it just means that every image can be variable. It doesn't need a printing plate. And it doesn't need all those traditional skills that we needed to run a traditional press. So we have a look at the kind of skills which have been taken out by this machine. We'll talk about this a little bit later on. It's not only in the label industry. At the same time as it's happening in the label industry, it's happening in the newspaper industry, the book printing industry. These are all the roles. I mean, when I first started out in trade journalism back in 1987, the first question they asked me was, do you want a manual or an electric typewriter? So that was always sort of a time of just kind of one career. So the typesetter was the person who would take the type and literally little bits of metal type and would put it into a chase, and then they'd ink it and they put it on a big press, and you'd have a proofreader, you then proof that, you'd make a bit of film out of it. From the film you'd make a plate. The ink mixer's job was to mix up the color, literally. So let's say that you wanted on a label in those days, a Cadbury's purple. You had a thing called an ink kitchen, and in the ink kitchen, the ink mixer by eye would mix these from various recipes that were kind of all patented and kind of carefully guarded secrets. Then, as we've seen, the printing press operator and their assistants would then mount those printing plates onto the press, and we'll put the ink into the ink pans, start the press up, and then they would spend the next 2 hours of kind of however long the job run, checking. I mean, for example, checking by eye with a strobe light, because the laser, these things running 150 meters a minute, you know, it's like 400 feet a minute. Checking with a strobe light, see if they could spot any printing errors. So it was really kind of skilled, intensive work. But all those skills then were all put in the bin as soon as that machine appeared in 1993. So here is in the Brave New World. You can see there again. So this is a typical inkjet print unit. These are the inkjet units in here, the four colors, cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. The papers are coming in here, or the film coming through here. It's being printed and it's coming out the finished label there. That's it. That's finished. So again, a similar thing here. You can see the inkjet heads here. That's the whole machine. And again, this one here. So, and it's, again, it's wider, really, as Mark's quite rightly pointed out, the way that these things ripple out. So many of the skills which were done before either job was even taken to the press. So, for example, color correction, color management, checking that the image is the correct image, it's the correct resolution. Checking that the imposition, which is when you're putting more than two or three labels across, say, a 13-inch web of material, how you fit them in like a jigsaw so they all fit properly. All that was done by eye before, bits of film, bits of film put manually onto a plate, a frame and such like, all gone. And all the areas of the school workflow are now cloud-based and fully automated. In addition, the worker, and I guess it's very typical of these industrial revolution type paradigms, is far more closely monitored. So whereas before, if it's taking you 4 or 5 hours to get a press ready to print, you know, and it's like, you know, in the and it's the unionized and stuff, so you go out and have a cigarette outside or come back and have a chat, you can kind of be a little bit relaxed about it, but now you can't, because now the digital press is now sending real-time information to the cloud. And that real-time information is being monitored automatically again by monitoring systems which appear on a tablet, say, of the plant supervisor, the managing director, the shareholders. Anybody can zoom in at any one time and see exactly what's happening with that worker. And what are the benefits to capital? So we mentioned earlier that industrial revolutions are only undertaken really for one reason, ultimately, because they benefit capital. And in many ways, so the range of ways in which they benefit capital. So obviously there's a reduced manual skilled workforce. So that's a lot of that's a lot of money saved in terms of paying for your workforce. The kind of skills you need to operate a digital press really is somebody who can work a computer. They don't need to have any of those old traditional print skills. And obviously those people are going to come cheaper. And you only need one, whereas before you might need around a traditional press, probably a team of 9 or 10 skilled people. Undermine the unionization, as we've seen, the British print industry, trade unions are pretty much dead. Increase of productivity. And for brands, the benefit of digital printing for brands is that basically now, as you can see on the right there, not everything has to be the same anymore. We're not talking about fixed image carrier. Every image can be different, so why not pretend that we know who Laura is and who Sarah is and who Dan is and Charlie, and persuade you to spend your hard-earned money on exactly the same product. And we'll call this mass personalization because we're Coke and we really love you. So that's the kind of benefits for capital. The digital print revolution is really, and again, the exponential speed that this happens, from that first press appearing as a prototype in 1995 to this company, EPAC, which started out about 3 years ago. They have no conventional printing presses at all. All the print operations in this company are digital presses. One person on a network can now send jobs to 4 or 5 machines. So we don't even need one person now at each machine. The other thing that that EPAC has done is people print pouches. They get cat food or tuna, whatever. But what they've also done, because it's all now on a network and because they're not reliant upon the old skills, they basically now have a network of plants all over the world, all over Europe, all over the US. And instead of printing in one place and trucking the printed products out, they now print locally and they distribute where the final customer is. So it's a real revolution now in logistics as well as everything else. And again, it's the way that the unintended consequences of these revolutions really, really kind of spread out. So the labor industry goes global. So the next thing I'm going to talk about, another aspect of the labor revolution, not specifically digital, although digital plays a part, as we'll see. But again, the time that I've been writing about this industry, we've seen a rapid globalization of the labor industry. This happened really because the global brands, as we know, global companies have to make money, make profits. Where they can make profits, they can't afford to be out of a market, even when it's a developing market, and in case they don't get a chance to establish their brand for when the really big profits start being made. as they are now in companies like China. So Tesco is one example. Walmart is another. If you go to Shanghai today, you blink twice and you could be in Croydon. You know, it's really kind of it's kind of really like that. Or the West End, probably. So the rapid spread of Western brands and retailers globally. And what this has meant is, so Tesco is selling basically the same branded products as it's selling in the UK, in China. So it's Dove shampoo, and it's all the rest of the Weetabix, whatever. So the packaging has to be the same because it's a global branded product. It's a global advertising campaigns. So the demand for locally produced labels. And what this has done in the last probably 10 years has propelled the development of local label printing industries. Digitally is starting to impact, as we'll see, but there's still a low price of labor, which means it's still not quite worth the owners of capital in those countries who own the label plants to invest in digital printing. It's still cheaper to just get in cheap labor, but that will change. It's already starting to change in China, where wage levels are starting to wage inflation is probably in a region of 7 to 9% year on year. So this is our very wonderful Label Expo show, and it shows you how the company has responded to this. See now the Label Expo show is now in India, two in China, in Chicago and the US, in Bangkok in Southeast Asia, in China, and in Europe, in Brussels. It's a very fabulous Label Expo China. This is the first show the company ran in China in 2005. In Shanghai, that's me looking very miserable on the far left-hand side. I'm kind of wondering what I'm doing there, really. The other gentlemen here are the members of the PIAC operation, which I'll talk about shortly. Very interesting in China, seeing state capitalism in action, kind of on the front end of things, and seeing, you know, the contradiction between the need to tightly control by the state what's going on, but at the same time to leave entrepreneurs enough commercial space to develop new products, rather than just copy products, or rather than be just a cheap workshop for Western brands. So during this period, the Chinese government was changing over from a kind of export-led economy, whereby, you know, just a cheap workshop for Nike to try to develop domestic demand. So as part of this, one of the reasons why the brand started making money, the global FMCG brands, the food and the drink people are making money in China when this policy change starts to happen. So that presents the labor industry. So now Labor Expo goes in there, and there is now a labor industry in China. What we do see is that in the early days, and again in sort of 2003, 2005, when we launched a show in China, every Chinese press manufacturer was doing pretty bad copies of machines that they'd seen in photographs from the West, or they come over to trade shows in Brussels or Chicago, copy machines, brought them back and done very crude copies of them. But really within kind of 10 to 12 years, and certainly now, the situation has completely changed. They're now using top of the market servo drive motors from companies like Siemens in Germany. They're making alliances with leading tech companies in the West to develop joint develop machinery. They're selling presses now in Europe, printing presses, label printing presses in Europe. And that's largely because the state has really put a lot of resources behind that. Whether or not there's any espionage going on, of course, we're not paranoid, we're not President Trump people, but you know, not to be put past people, the state is basically behind every company. We call this the ginger root theory, and which I'm just going to talk about briefly now. So this is PIAC. PIAC is the Printing Industry Association of China. That's me doing my selling thing. Second from the right there. PIAC is, so the way it works in China effectively is that PIAC is the kind of, the Chinese government has set these trade organizations kind of semi-loose to, they have to be profitable. They have to make a profit for the state, but at the same time, they're tied to the state. So they act as a conveyor belt for state information. So, for example, the Chinese state decides that sustainability is going to be an important factor in the print industry. So it basically encourages, very strongly encourages, Chinese printing press manufacturers to develop printing presses that don't use solvents. So they stop developing gravure presses. They start developing presses with inks that are dried by UV light or by hot air. So this is the way it works. And then this chap in the middle there, with the glasses, and the sort of orangey black tie, this chap here is Mr. Tan. Mr. Tan's got a fascinating history, and he goes right back to the sort of Cultural Revolution. But he's a real survivor. But his job also is to feed back to the Chinese Communist Party, to the correct committee, the requirements of the printing industry. So, you know, he travels around all the print shops in China, just seeing whether regulations are working, enforcing them, obviously. But then if things don't work, or if there are any kind of issues, need to be fed back, not to say they'll be acted upon. But so that's kind of, we call it a ginger root because, you know, it took us probably four or five different associations before we found the right one. And the ginger root is you pull a ginger up and it pulls up, all the roots come out with it. So when you pull PIAC, all the right kind of associations and all the right kind of companies and government contacts come up with it. So you don't do anything in China unless you're working with a government government-sponsored organization, which is PIAC. They did incidentally try to launch a show against Tarsus a few years ago. That's another thing, really, that again, like the printing press is, they're trying to kind of not be beholden to what they still see as a kind of outsiders, imperialists, as they called it, the imperialist states. So even in the label industry, they're trying to basically cut links with companies like our one. This is just for fun, really. This is kind of what a Chinese printing plant looks like on the right, like a palace. Huge red marble floors and there's things. This machine up here is a company called Three Gorges. Three Gorges Printing. They print cigarette cartons, and there's around about 145 brands of cigarettes in China. There's no chance ever of a smoking ban ever happening. You can see that they're running through some holograms through that printing press here, in order to safeguard them against counterfeiting, et cetera, but this company is right by the Three Gorges Dam, which is devastating the Yangtze River at the moment, which is another part of the plenty of interesting photographs of that. So what else do we have here on the lower left? This is a printing plant where they're manufacturing the printing presses. India is a different story. So we company launched a show in India just after launching the show in China, again because the brands were moving into India. There's no direct state involvement in the labor industry in India as there is with in China. Certainly very much for a case of local initiatives, and they just want to make money, really. Obviously, as everybody does. There's been a massive mall building program in the last 10 years. You know, from where our exhibition is in a place called Gurgaon, which is probably about 10 miles outside Delhi, along that highway is now packed with huge shopping malls that weren't there even sort of eight or nine years ago. But frustratingly for the brand, it's a highly fragmented market, and it's really beholden to kind of street violence and kind of street culture, because it's mostly wet markets in India still. Most people shop in wet markets, not the kind of affluent, more affluent middle class. They're shopping in malls. But what happens is that when Tesco or Walmart says it's going to build a retail plant, and basically overnight they come and burn it down, or there are street protests, and they basically you have to have an Indian partner if you want to operate in India. So it's kept the brands away. So they've tried, and obviously it's a massive market they'd love to get their hands on, but it's still highly fragmented. So what this means in turn is that in India, the label market is still relatively undeveloped, as you can see from these photographs on the tech bus here. I mean, you can see all the exposed wiring on the walls, condensation on ceilings. All the time in my labor industry, I don't think I've ever been quite so terrified. And you see here the die cutting unit cuts out the shape of the label. Still the same basic machine, but a couple of generations back. See here, manual labor. We haven't really seen any automation in India, because you can still get people off the streets so cheaply that it's really not been worth the while of the capitalist class. They're really pursuing automation. Let's talk about briefly what the impact has been of COVID-19. And what it's really done is it's greatly increased the drive to automation. And also to digital printing, and particularly in the Chinese market. And the reason for this is because when the pandemic broke in China, so the way factories work in China, even including label printing factories, is that they bring in the kind of peasants from the countryside, or countryside migrant workers really, and they build dormitories for them, and they actually live on site. And they're lucky if they go home to see their families once every couple of years, or on the lunar holidays, Chinese New Year, they're allowed to go home. But they have to be back at a certain time, and it has to be staggered. But what happened when the pandemic struck was that all these workers were scattered. So you're not only the fact that that the dormitories were emptied, but it was really hard for them to get back because all the transit networks. I mean, bear in mind that, you know, that somebody comes from the countryside, it wouldn't be the local countryside, say to Shanghai, it could be anywhere in the country. So they couldn't get back because the transport links were down, and some printing plants were without their kind of most skilled laborers, sometimes for weeks. And at the same time, there was lots of business. You can see from that photograph up here, all these sanitary products have got labels. I mean, a lot of the label industry boomed during the COVID. You know, these kind of stickers and anything that's self-adhesive you could cut out of a sheet. So the frustration was for the capital owners in China who owned the printing plants was that they couldn't get skilled labourers. The presses were down. Even when the workers came back, you couldn't get in these cramped kind of printing plants. You know, you couldn't get two press operators around a press. You had to socially distance, and you physically couldn't do it. So what happened in China is that we've seen a really massive drive towards automation. But the same thing has been happening also in Europe and in North America. Just got two more slides here. What are the consequences of digital printing? Again, it's not all in a wider sense. Again, as Marx was talking about the opportunities and the vistas that get opened up by industrial revolutions. So, for example, if you look at book printing, digital print, this is a digital book printing press. So the paper comes in here, it's printed here. You have a digital book binding operation here with digital application of glue and such like, and what comes out at the end is a finished book. Again, because not using printing plates here, you can print just a single print. And what it means is that no book is ever out of print anymore. Because you can always, as long as a digital copy of it exists somewhere in the world, you can always print a single copy. The digital industry has removed the need for dangerous chemicals. So when I was used to first going to those early printing plants, they're using solvents to etch the dots on the printing plates and to clean up the press. You know, solvents were kind of lethal, they're carcinogenic, highly explosive, heavy lifting. So to cut out the shape of the label, you'd be lifting enormously heavy printing dies, die cutting units, over the press, bending over and lifting these things off. That's all gone with the digital presses. They tend to use lasers to cut out the shapes of the labels. Greatly reduced energy use. I mean, obviously, you're not running those enormously long printing presses. And every time that you change over a job in a conventional printing label press, you're probably wasting 200 to 300 meters of material just to get the machine running again. And obviously, with a digital press, when you change a job, you just change it over, and it instantly changes over with no waste. The other consequence has been, as we've seen with that company, EPAC, that these machines can now be placed at the point of production or the point of distribution, in a warehouse, in a factory, rather than having to print centrally, probably more than you need, and drive them to a warehouse and stick them in a warehouse with all the energy costs of running warehouses. So the idea of having a distributed printing network. And final slide. So I'm just kind of thinking about bearing in mind what's happened with the digital printing revolution. In a social society, what kind of skills will we choose to keep? So the first point is that even under capitalism, the driving force behind digitization has been profit accumulation. Capital accumulation. But we still see actually a really lively small scale cottage industry, really, of people doing letterpress. Going back to those old skills, of making the type, setting the type, of getting a platen with pressure and pressing that down to get the impression from the letterpress, and screen printing. Obviously, we know has kind of never gone away, but really kind of art printing. Printing with screens. A question which kind of arose to me was, well, what will be the function of a label actually in a society of common ownership? Because obviously, let's take a shampoo label. Next time you go shopping, just take a look at how many shampoo brands there are and sub brands. We know it all does the same thing, because when we go to a hotel, everyone's perfectly happy to use whatever kind of crappy shampoo that they've got there in the bathroom. So we know that it all has the same effect. But in a battle to sell you a particular brand over another brand, there's a whole industry that's looking at what colours impact upon our subconscious, the position of the brand on the shelf in terms of the height where it's positioned. All these kind of things. That's what a label does. The function of it is to sell you a product. So when we're not in the game of having to sell competitive products, then the function of a label presumably will be simply informational, just to tell us kind of what a product did, how to use it, or will we still be interested in getting a kind of a good feeling around a product, using bright pieces of flowers on dishwashing liquid. I don't know. That's a question which I thought was interesting. So we'd like to move, I think, probably back to a situation where we have both craft elements and production elements, because where we're going to be wanting to kind of print out instruction leaflets and labels for pharmaceutical products, for example, then that's where you're going to probably need those this kind of distributed digital printing networks. But at the same time, we're going to be free to go back to developing craft elements. Even some people who send me press releases every now and again are doing illuminated manuscripts in the old ways of, with a stone, crayons and stone, who knows. Certainly setting type by hand. So if you see on the right-hand side there, that's what was around when I first started writing about the industry back in the 80s, where the skilled craftsperson, normally a man, craftsman, would take each individual letter. Every space between letters would also be a little bit of lead, the leading. For newspapers, magazines, or for books, they were manually put together, which were beautiful. The type was beautiful. What you'll now see when you see a book or a paper that's been automated, put together by an automated system that does this, automated type system, you'll often see that it'll spread out a word. It used to happen particularly sort of 10 years ago. You read a newspaper and one word would be spread out across a whole column, because they weren't using those old skills. It was just an automated program. So I think that going back to these kind of, setting type by hand and these elements will certainly, make a comeback, and that'll be entirely a good thing. So with that, that's the end of my talk. Thank you.